according to Fritz Machlup, an economist from Princeton. And I will say that this, I have a very long quote here, which I'm not going to read, but I urge you all to look it up. It's in a Brookings study called Measuring the Value of Government Investments. He was a commentator, and I'm sure his comments were aimed as much at his own colleagues as anyone. He says, in part, that he's noticed a tendency to make a distinction between economic and non-economic values. I submit that this is a mistake. We must not put economic values to one side and other values, say ethical, aesthetic, social, political, or human, to the other side. The economic valuation of benefits and costs of an institution, plan, or activity must attempt to take account of values of any sort and to apply reasoned argument and rational weighting to problems commonly approached only by visceral emoting, and so on. Now, Life magazine recently spoke of the environmental side effect of the activities of government and industry. This thinking of consequences as side effects is the crux of the matter, as ecologists and economists have shown. It's the choice of framework for analysis that determines whether effects of an action are considered internal to it or only external side effects. The problem is one of somehow taking note of all costs and all benefits, so there will be no effects that are side. The analysis and decision process can then, as the economists say, internalize the externalities, be truly comprehensive in considering the values and trade-offs, and identify who is actually paying or not paying whom for what in the proposed action. It is well to examine also who gains what and who loses what in each one of these issues. There has to be a framework to do it with. Now, Garrett Hardin, an ecologist, has described the issue this way in a recent Science article. We want the maximum good per person, but what is good? To one person, it's wilderness. To another, it's ski lodges for thousands. To one, it is estuaries to nourish ducks for hunters to shoot. To another, it's factory land. Comparing one good with another is, we usually say, impossible, because incommensurables cannot be compared. Theoretically, this may be true, but in real life, incommensurables are commensurable. Only a criterion of judgment and a system of weighting are needed. In nature, the criterion is survival. Is it better for a species to be small and hideable or large and powerful? Natural selection commensurates the incommensurables. The compromise achieved depends on a natural weighting of the values of the variables. Man must imitate this process. There is no doubt that, in fact, he already does, but unconsciously. It's when the hidden decisions are made explicit that the arguments begin. The problems for the years ahead is to work out an acceptable theory of weighting. So we want to make choices explicit, commensurate the incommensurables, and internalize the externalities. And we know that ecology should play a role, and that these decisions should concern action before they happen, rather than just trying to correct newly recognized mistakes. This will not be easy. Professor Caldwell reminded us earlier, another occasion, that unfortunately the environment as a whole is not a republic or a public responsibility. Going to the moon was a public responsibility. The environment is everyone's and no one's. But my message is that we should try to look at the problem as all of one piece. Let us realize that the whole question goes right back to a fundamental principle of ecosystems and a great many other natural phenomena, the cybernetic model. Let us stop differentiating between the legitimacy of natural or social science concerns and simply say that we are talking about a recognizable man-environment system, a system, one which should be a cybernetic system, a system that should be characterized by the operation of feedback control mechanisms, by negative feedback that prevents excess in any direction. But as we see in reality, a system that is instead obviously out of control and where positive feedback is the order of the day in many different directions, especially in population growth and technological developments. C.P. Snow has recently commented on this, saying, "There's no known example in which technology has been stopped being pushed to the limit. Technology has its own inner dynamic. It would be reassuring to find one case in which technology was called off. At present, we are letting technology ride us as though we had no judgment of our own. The demon of progress in technology is making us all behave as though we had our brains amputated. All positive, no negative feedback, in other words. But this has to be a cybernetic or feedback control system, and if it's on a human scale, we must have rational, purposeful control. Decisions and solutions rather than just outcomes as in simpler ecosystems. If there is to be control, there has to be a functioning negative feedback loop that does certain things, a feedback loop. This loop will sense and measure the outputs of the system. It will signal the results to some mechanism for comparing the results with goals established for the system, note any discrepancies, then signal corrective action to those points in the system that can alter the output or whatever it is that the system is doing. This, it seems to me, is a model to use in looking at our environmental crisis." Now, this was just one sentence, and really the model is that simple, and it must be insulting to those of you that are very familiar with this sort of thing to even mention it this way. But this kind of thinking is characteristic of a new hybrid discipline that is coming to be identified as a system science in its own right. It is often confused with computer applications and a great many other near and distant activities, but in its development in the general systems theories of von Bredelanffy and others, it may well become the ultimate integrator of science and human affairs. Nevertheless, based partially on the original contributions of the ecosystem concept, this broader kind of systems thinking may now even be familiar to more non-ecologists than to ecologists. The systems approach, which Frank has already mentioned, has unfortunately been tainted with Defense Department controversy. And the phrase systems analysis, which is now becoming commonplace, unfortunately is also ambiguous very often. You can't be sure what's intended until you've questioned the user about his definitions and his purposes. But we know what Eugene Odom, another ecologist, means when he uses it in this context. He says, "Although we readily recognize that we can have too many dams or other large-scale environmental changes, governments are so fragmented and lacking in systems analysis capabilities that there's no effective mechanism whereby negative feedback signals can be received and acted on before there's been a serious overshoot. Society needs and must find as quickly as possible a way to deal with landscape as a whole so that manipulative skills, that is technology, will not run too far ahead of our understanding of the impact of change." Well, now in conclusion, my own bias must be visible. I think ecology is running interference on this play, but I don't think it can score. Man's environmental and other social problems, for that matter, demand a kind of unified, integrated attention that no existing discipline or simple combination of disciplines can supply, in my opinion. The imminent emergence of a new systems science holds promise. And I assure you, I'm not naively buying a snow job. And this is the danger when we start talking systems. There are so many people trying to peddle various system services and systems concepts that it's awfully hard not to feel like a sheep or a victim. Nevertheless, I think the real value is there. This systems approach also holds threats to our established ways of doing business. For one thing, our systems approach calls for much more effective planning, and it also implies the existence of identifiable goals, as well as the feedback mechanisms. And I hope that Professor Caldwell will tell us how things are going in this mystifying area, and believe me, it is. Now, to conclude, Let me quote something that Bertrand Russell said some time ago, and I hope no one falls into the genetic fallacy here. Russell said something like this: "We usually appeal to nobler motives to accomplish the very things that calculated selfishness would dictate if only the calculations were correct. We usually appeal to nobler motives to accomplish the very things that calculated selfishness would dictate if only the calculations were correct." Now, can ecology make the calculations correct? Ecologists can deal with large comprehensive systems as well as their own ecosystems once they learn how. It is being done from many different directions. Frank Darling's countryman, Ian McHarg, is a good example from another field. Or will ecologists and other scientists who are being brought into the act prefer to retain their professional purity and hope that their data will be used and try to save the world on their own time? I'm optimistic, but I don't think we should forget the gentle reminder of Pierre Dansereau, one of our real senior ecologists, whose gentle reminder was this: "No, my dear ecologists, our task is not done." Thank you.
Our task is not done, but coffee is available, so we will have a short intermission. And please come back at 10:35. On the subject of systems in the general ecological context, and it's appropriate, I think, that we move from the general to the somewhat more specific and begin to, as I understand the paper, talk some about institutional systems in relationship to conservation and environmental considerations. So the next third and final paper this morning, Public Policy for the Environment, by Professor Linton K. Caldwell of the Department of Government at Indiana University. Dr. Caldwell.
Thank you very much, Dr. Martz. Ladies and gentlemen, like Frank Darling, I prepared a manuscript before coming here, but after having listened to many of the sessions during this Alaska Science Conference, and particularly the messages of our two luncheon speakers prior to today, it seemed to me that I could do something more appropriate than simply to give you an abstract of the paper, which in any event I've turned over to Victor Fisher. Instead, it seems more appropriate for the present purpose to try now to put into some form of synthesis, into some type of context, the discussions that we've been having about the question of environmental policy for Alaska. In doing so, I shan't try to speak to the immediate problems of Alaska, that is to say, the specific problems, but rather I will try to place Alaska's policy need at the present time in the perspective, first of all, of its relationship to the United States generally, and then to the globe itself, to the biosphere that Frank Darling spoke about, which even now we are constrained to bring under some form of policy organization in the interest of human survival. But first, I think it may be in order to say a word about policy. We've heard discussions of ecology and what ecology means. We've been using the word policy, but we've had very little comment about what we mean by policy. And I can tell you what it means to me. In the broad sense, policy includes the values, goals, laws, and ethics of people. And it is inseparable from their lifestyle, real policy. It is not only what people profess, what their governments profess, what they profess as individuals or groups, but it is also what they do. The form and substance, then, of the institutions and the practices that add up to what we call policy are closely related to technology, and it, of course, is a dynamic, changing force in our lives. It is related to ideas, to the dynamics of population, to the value structure I've suggested. Policy, basically, is the outcome of politics. It's the outcome of a social decision process as to what is preferable. Now, as we look at the relationship of science to this policy process, we need always to keep in mind the thing that Bob Scott reminded us of just a few minutes ago, that policy may be based upon science. You can utilize science, but science is not self-executory. All of the scientific knowledge in the world will not accomplish anything until it is made operational through institutions, through administrative practices, through programs, through budgets, through systems, if you will. Now, I would like to focus the broad consideration of policy upon the more specific one of the environment, although this is not a very specific focus, to be sure, because environment in itself is a very broad and complex concept. But I think the question that is particularly pertinent at this time and needs to be understood in its full meaning here in Alaska is why the environment has now become such a focus of national and indeed international concern. Why now? Certainly this concern is something other than the conservation movement that we've been familiar with in the past. When we speak of the environment, we're not talking about the allocation of resource use, although it includes that. We're talking about something far more fundamental, far more pervasive. Now, what my remarks then will attempt to do will be to explain what this broad and pervasive area of policy really is, not just what it looks like on the surface, but what it is underneath. But in order to do this and make it relevant to the Alaskan situation, seems to me best to examine this meaning of environmental policy from the point of view of where we are here in Alaska, in this place and at this time. Now, Alaska is coming of age, so to speak, that is to say, into statehood and into a new phase of techno-economic development under unprecedented circumstances for this earth. And it comes of age under circumstances that, on the one hand, offer tremendous opportunities to this Commonwealth and this people here for a better life, for a richer life, a more rational life, a more totally satisfying life than most of the people on the earth have known. On the other hand, there are also great potentials in the situation in which Alaska now finds itself for mass frustration, for social conflict, and for estrangement from the rest of the United States. And I emphasize that last point. I think it's very real. There may well be some unhappy times in some quarters in Alaska when the, I hesitate to use the word, but I shall, where the obsolete perceptions and ambitions of people here in Alaska find themselves in confrontation with a new approach to life and politics that is rapidly shaping up throughout the United States as a whole and is present here in Alaska too. Now, let me just enumerate, to be more specific, a number of the considerations in which I suggest there could be this frustration, this conflict, and this estrangement. It's evident that here in Alaska, in the minds of many of its citizens, there is an image of the traditional American frontier. There's a feeling in the minds of some people, I'm sure, here, that Alaska has a right to have its frontier, that it has a right to go through the same kind of economic development, that the same type of, again, I hesitate to say it, but I'll say get rich quick, the same philosophy of come and get it that all the rest of the United States has had. And there's going to be moral indignation when some federal bureaucrat, some act of Congress, some conservation groups say, no, the frontier concept is obsolete. Alaska can't be that kind of frontier. It has no place in the world of the 1970s. Well, now why doesn't it? Well, we'll come to that. But there's another element in the picture that can lead to frustration, conflict, and estrangement, and that is in the wealth itself. You know, so often the story of unhappiness in families is when some rich uncle died and left a lot of money, and the family began to fight over the proceeds. And the peculiar kind of wealth that Alaska has suddenly come into is a particularly mischievous kind. Now, I don't for a moment want to appear to be knocking riches from oil, but I would like to remind the conference, and I'm not the first to do it, that oil has often proved a curse as a benefit. And if you look at the countries in which there has been massive dependence upon oil, you see, along with good things, an increase in social and political instability, corruption, and ecological deterioration. Now, I don't suggest that these things are inherent in oil or the production of oil. And I'm inclined to share Fraser Darling's optimism that the oil industry and the industrial sector generally in society has also matured a great deal in recent decades. But I do think we have to refute history if Alaska's story is to be different than that of many other countries. Now, there's a third problem, and that is the heavy responsibility which statehood places on this Commonwealth. I was for 4 years Director of Research and Publications for the Council of State Governments, and I don't therefore speak about state government simply from an academic ivory tower. If Alaska rises to the occasion as a state, and I'm speaking now about the government itself, the political parties in Alaska, the government in Juneau, and the employees of the state government, if it rises to this challenge of the oil and the development of Alaska, it will do, at least in my judgment, what no other state has yet done. I think the record of state government in the United States generally for playing a far-sighted, responsible, and effective role in the nation's development has been very disappointing. There are bright spots. There are states that seem to have the will to govern themselves. But one cannot say this for the greater number of the 50 states. This is just a fact of life. You can challenge it. The burden, I think, is on someone to disprove it. There's abundant testimony to the failure of state government to be effective in a planning, in a leadership, in a guiding role. By and large, the states lack the will to govern responsibly. This is something perhaps inherent in their constitution or in the way the parties work in the states. They lack competent personnel because they will not provide appropriate institutional arrangements to obtain it. They lack effective administrative organization. They lack the ability to marshal knowledge to plan or execute plans. Dr. Dettinger, lunch the other day, outlined a rather sad picture of the extent to which the states use scientific knowledge in the development of their own futures. And finally, the states, by and large, do not have the broadly representative and responsive character that I think we would have to concede that in most cases the federal government has. And I'm aware of the infirmities and iniquities of the federal government in certain respects. But the history of state government is that it is much more susceptible to control by powerful and particularized cliques and economic interest groups. Now, these are what you might call political facts of life that have been demonstrated over the years in the other states. And it's a good question, I think, to ask, why should Alaska be different? Why should we assume that this state is going to have a picture that is quite different from that which we have seen in most of the other states? And finally, Alaska also faces apparently major problems of ethnic and cultural relationships at a time when the dominant culture, as someone spoke of the Euro-American, the so-called white American, at a time when that culture is under massive challenge from within as well as from without, and indeed in many ways is showing evidence of disintegration. Well, I've attended a number of the sessions on the various concerns here of the Eskimo and Indian people in Alaska, and I've heard a good deal about acculturation, the influence of the culture coming from the South into Alaska. And the word acculturation, I'm not sure what that means, because anymore I wonder, acculturation to what? We're all being acculturated. What is the culture of the future? I think this is it's been suggested by a number of the anthropologists here that somebody ought to study, you see, the white man in Alaska, or someone suggested there ought to be a foundation to study the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant population of the United States, and that would include the white Northwest European Catholic or Jewish population. It's all pretty much in the past one large kind of macroculture. But it's undergoing all kinds of change now and instability. What kind of culture is that? And when we talk about the interaction between the traditional cultures in Alaska and this so-called white European-derived culture, what do we mean? Certainly there's a large area of confusion here. And in many ways, the so-called native peoples of Alaska and the newcomers in Alaska are on a common footing, on a footing of equality, in that none of them have institutions at this point in the history of the world that are really appropriate to grapple with the problems that we have. Dr. Glass spoke yesterday of this inadequacy of our educational structure and institutions. and I would add our political structure and institutions, to cope with the kind of problems that have now developed in this world. And it's perhaps then appropriate that we turn from Alaska to this world to understand how we got into the predicament in which I would suggest we find ourselves. And I would go back again to a point that was stressed by Fraser Darling this morning earlier and by Bentley Glass yesterday, and say once more that where we are now is at the end of a long journey, a journey of perhaps 25,000 years that began sometime in the Pleistocene, the great ice ages. And during that interval, man began to occupy the habitats of the natural world. And it took him perhaps 25,000 years or more to do this, but he has now done it in the 20th century. The human animal has now fully occupied all of the niches, so to speak, as the ecologist would say, or the natural habitats on the earth that are easily available to him, and he's used all kinds of culture-derived methods, such as irrigation and heating systems and so on, to invade and occupy areas that are not hospitable to him. The real estate on the earth is taken up. It's all subdivided. We're at the end of the age of infinity. We can no longer pretend, you know, that there are horizons or frontiers. And this is why I say the concept of the frontier in Alaska is utterly obsolete and inappropriate. This is why, however, we as a frontier-oriented people, as the American people, it may be true also of the Russian people, I'm not sure, that have been situated in vast continental land masses. The world seems so large. This is why we could for so long act as if there was an infinite environment. But now we find ourselves emerging into the era of spaceship Earth, as it has been called. And I suggest, ladies and gentlemen, that this is a utterly new situation for the human species. This is not just a change of magnitude, I think, in the situation. I firmly believe that this is a change of state. The whole concept of spaceship Earth, I suggest, is a very radical concept with tremendous implications for politics, for economics, and for society generally. Now, there are many other manifestations of this emergence into the world of the spaceship Earth. Human populations, and we've had this statement made again and again, have reached a critical level in the world generally, although not perhaps in Alaska. Population growth, in the judgment, I think, of all well-informed biologists, demographers, ecologists, must be arrested and will be arrested by one means or another in the relatively near future. In any case, it will not be arrested without a great deal of pain and travail, and indeed perhaps disaster. The degree to which we can mitigate this disaster and this pain will depend, again, upon wisdom and our use of science. But clearly, the handwriting is on the wall. As Dr. Glass pointed out yesterday, you cannot maintain the exponential indefinitely. This is not in the nature of physical reality. It simply won't work. Now, in addition to the escalation of population, we've had this escalation of science-based technology and of information. And it's, again, quite clear, as Fraser Darling said, that the extent of this knowledge and this technological capacity has escalated beyond the capacity of our institutions to handle it wisely. We now are really in the age also of the technological overreach. technology seems to be self-augmenting, seems to have a momentum of its own. I say seems because it really doesn't. What technology does is what we do with it. And what we have done with it, you see, is to perceive it within the from the viewpoint with the perceptions of the past. When the earth was small, the fit, so to speak, between man and his environment was loose. He could afford to make errors. He could afford to ruin an environment because all he had to do was pick up and move away. Sometimes, like the Mongols and the Turks, he had to take somebody else's environment. But by and large, at least in the earlier periods of human society, the earth was so big that he did not have to worry greatly about the impact of his technology. It wasn't powerful enough, and he wasn't numerous enough. But now I suggest, when you move from the illusion of an open space society and an open space world into the world as the astronauts saw it, as we've all now seen it from outer space, a major reorientation of attitude and of social effort is indicated. We have many pessimistic prophets as to what may happen if man does not make this transition. If he does not, so to speak, reorient himself to the realities of spaceship Earth. We've heard this from very competent biologists such as Paul Ehrlich, C.S. Hollings, Garrett Hardin. We've heard it from sociologists, economists. It's not a question, you see, of whether we really care about the environment in one respect, whether we want to do anything about it at all. If we are really concerned with the survival of the human species, we have no choice. And it's desirable, however, to recognize that the concept of the biosphere, the unity, the ecological unity of the Earth, is in a very large way, although not in all detail, but in a very large way, comparable to the life support system of the spaceship. And you can't behave irrationally with respect to that system and that spaceship, and you cannot be irresponsible about tinkering with its gadgetry, and you can't start fighting, you know, back and forth in the aisles. You also cannot be altogether uninhibited about your right to exploit some aspect of that spaceship environment. And certainly you have to pay attention to the concept of carrying capacity. Now, the whole life view, I suggest, of the world of the spaceship is revolutionary. And I come back again to the fundamental equality here of circumstance in Alaska, of the Eskimo and the Indian and the European. The world perception of the Eskimo, I would suggest, is no more valid than the traditional worldview of the American settler. And maybe it may be even more valid, for all I know. But there is a very fundamental equality here that ought to be recognized. We all have to build something new because we've worked ourselves into a situation that is new. Now, there are people that see this, and they're not all in universities by any means. Indeed, the universities, I regret to say, have been slow. We in the academic world sometimes like to point finger of scorn, you know, at the politician who is usually corruptible and a little stupid according to some ways of thinking. And yet I would say that perhaps the most realistic, the most perceptive uniting of thought and action on this at the present time is going on in government, in some of the administrative agencies, and at the present time, most particularly in the Congress of the United States. And I think that there is an insufficient awareness of the extent to which the senators and congressmen, certain of these men and their committees, are concerned, very much concerned, and very intelligently concerned, and very realistically concerned with the predicament that we are now in. It's not for nothing that we now have at least 35 bills introduced into the Congress that in various ways propose to either establish or declare a national policy for the environment, or to provide mechanism through which such a policy could be developed. The Nixon administration has established an Environmental Quality Council, consisting of the president himself as its chairman and selected members of the cabinet, and the vice president as its members. It was suggested by Robert Kahn, writing in the Christian Science Monitor, the president didn't do this because he was so interested in the environment and its problems that he wasn't necessarily strongly oriented this way, although he did make one address on this subject during his campaign. What Kahn suggested was that the executive appointed Environmental Quality Council was established as a result of public pressure. Another demonstration of the extent of public awareness and the congressional realization of this took place when Governor Hickel came up for confirmation as Secretary of the Interior. I hardly need remind you of the nature of the hearings that took place. Time magazine has referred to what it calls the education of Wally Hickel, not only in the period of confirmation, before confirmation, but in the events that have occurred since, and more particularly the Santa Barbara oil spill, but this is only one of many. It may well be that Governor Hickel represents in a very good way the process of reorientation that we all have to go through under these circumstances, that his earlier life experience led him to a set of conclusions that he now finds himself constrained to change, and I suggest possibly not merely because of political pressure, but because he is in a position to see things that he couldn't see before from where he was situated. This concern that is manifest in the Congress then over a new responsibility, a new formulation of responsibility for the environment, is a part of what some people call the new politics. Bob Scott referred to the underground press. We see on the college campuses these days this concern. Peter Drucker, in a very perceptive and prophetic article in 1965, predicted that the quality of life, the politics of the quality of life, was to be the key to the politics of the new era, not the old issues of the New Deal, although these were still the issues that were being flogged in the last campaign by Mr. Humphrey and Mr. Nixon. And I suggest that one of the reasons of the great lack of enthusiasm for either candidate on the part of almost anybody under 30 was the irrelevance, really. It seemed that the candidates couldn't forget that FDR was resting in Hyde Park and that the Depression was over, that we were facing a completely new kind of world. Now, the so-called new politics may be misguided in many ways. It may be callow and irrational. But I suggest that for all its irrationality, it could hardly be more irrational than the preservation of many of our 19th century attitudes as the 20th century, as the 21st century approaches. The refutation of the irrationality of the kids, if you don't like the irrationality, is to get with a higher order of irrationality ourselves. Now let me conclude then by trying to state, as honestly as I can, what I think the environmental policy issue really is all about. And Dr. Martz really suggested it in his introduction. The great challenge to Alaska, as I see it in the environmental policy issue, as to the United States as a whole, is not oil, but its intelligence and ethics. Basically, we are concerned with a moral problem. We hear a good deal about the ecological crisis. Well, there is an ecological crisis, to be sure, and it's been documented. But the crisis that we ought to be concerned about primarily, I think, is a crisis of the will. A crisis in the ability of men to unite intelligence with a new order of ethics. Now, this is a challenge that's common to all human society. The General Assembly of the United Nations has acted on this. The Biosphere Conference, meeting in Paris just a year ago, convened by UNESCO, has resolved about in a series of very, I think, in the long run, significant resolutions, some of which are leading to action on this matter. Now, we're not talking about the small ethics of the cash register here, cash register honesty. I don't disparage that. But that's not the kind of ethical issue that confronts us. It's the large ethics of the purpose and values and outcomes of life. There is, as I suggested, an ecological crisis, or a crisis of man in relation to his environment. But it's a moral crisis born out of man's disrespect for the very process that brought him into existence and sustains him on this very improbable planet. The consequences of this disrespect, as Fraser Darling has so well put it, is dereliction. Disrespect is an evidence of lack of understanding, lack of regard, the unwillingness to take time, the unwillingness to be thoughtful. And I suggest that disrespect for the world that has evolved here over several millions of years, that we know to be unique in the solar system. And whatever its statistical probability of such another world is in the universe, that mathematical or stochastic figure is quite irrelevant to our problems until massive changes occur in our energy systems, in our physiology. A world upon which is congenial to life as we know it is far beyond the reach of man in any personal sense. Now, we know something about this through science, and we know a great deal more than we apply, about this highly improbable complex, an interrelated ecosystem called the Earth. And as Bob Scott said, in using the beautiful words of Edna St. Vincent Millay, we've had a really meteoric shower of knowledge, but we have not found the means to organize it. And I suggest we have not found the means to organize it because the purpose and will has not been there. And the major policy issue, therefore, I think, before us is to somehow find a way to articulate the goal and to help us muster the will. And I would suggest that if indeed, as I believe it is, we are confronted fundamentally with a moral and an ethical problem, that no man can be ethical by himself. How can you be ethical if you were thrown out? You were the last man on earth, you see. It's a point that Garrett Hardin has beautifully illustrated in his essay on the tragedy of the commons with respect to the problems of population control. We can't be ethical just by ourselves. We wouldn't know how to be. Now, if we want an ethic for the environment, we're really talking about an ethic for man, man in relation to his environment. There is the most false dichotomy, I think, of all the false dichotomies in the world, is one that juxtaposes man with nature, or even man and environment. Man is a part of his environment. He's inseparable from it, as he's inseparable from nature. If we are disrespectful, if we are contemptuous of nature, we are contemptuous indeed of ourselves. And it is not merely being facetious to say that a policy for the polar bear or a policy for the Alaska salmon is also a policy for man. If you're contemptuous of life or any part of it, you're contemptuous of the system that brought you into existence. And I suggest this is a highly immoral and dangerous point of view. Now then, as to the specifics of a national policy for the environment, I suspect that our discussants be in position to comment. I know that with respect to the Senate Bill 1075, a bill introduced by Senator Jackson, the Senate Interior Committee to declare a national policy for the environment. This bill has passed the Senate, is now in the House of Representatives. We have in this measure a concrete and specific and action-forcing piece of legislation that is intended to help us be moral on this question of the environment and to unite morality and intelligence. And I think, therefore, that my point has surely been made, that the task of assessing alternatives with respect to the environment and arriving at specific policies for the human treatment of the environment can begin to acquire purpose and direction once we have understood what the challenge really is. But I would only add this one note of warning, in that we know what we do, that if we follow the direction that I've suggested toward creating institutions and attitudes and values and procedures appropriate to an age of spaceship Earth, this effort will take us very far from where we are now, very far from the kind of society in which we now live. Not necessarily one less congenial to us, but a different one. And this, I think, we have to be quite frank, quite honest with ourselves, and recognize that what we are speaking about now is fundamental change in the human condition.